Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Cellacast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Friday, May 13th, 2005, and this is show number one. Hi, this is Allison Sheridan, and welcome to the NoCilla Podcast, or NoCillaCast for short. NoCillaCast is a chronicle of the technology news that I glean from sources such as the Wall Street Journal, using Walter Mossberg's Technology Journal, Leo Laporte's Radio, TV, and Books on Technology. I like Wired Magazine as a good source. I read PC and Mac magazines and various technology podcasts. I've used the term podcast several times here, so let me explain to you what it is. Podcasting is sort of like TiVo. Think about it as time-shifting for audio content. Or if you were around in the 1970s, more like recording radio stations that you liked and putting it on cassette tape so you could listen to it later or share with your friends. It pulls the entire... The thing that's different about this podcasting stuff, though, is it takes the content that you're interested in listening to and it pulls it to your iTunes library when you're not worrying about it. It goes out and it says, oh, there's a podcast Allison wants to listen to. Let me pull that in and I'm going to stick it in her iTunes library. So the next time she connects to play it on her computer or to connect to her iPod or other MP3 player, she can take that with her or record it onto a CD. I actually do it most of the time. I record it to CDs. The podcasts I listen to, I record them to CDs, and then I listen to them in the car, and then I share them with my friends like Namdar and Nancy, and we listen to these things in the car and have a lot of fun with it. I also listen to them on an iPod when I go jogging. So it's kind of an interesting way to get audio content, to get people talking, the music content, all different kinds of things.
Hey, wait a minute. What's going on here? That doesn't sound right. Well, it turns out that was the very first NoCillaCast broadcast on May 13th, 2005, exactly 2 years ago today. I thought you might enjoy hearing the earliest show I did. As you can tell, I didn't even vaguely follow the format from 2 years ago. I was expecting that all I would be able to do is regurgitate what other people said. Just tell you whatever Walter Mossberg wrote that week in the Wall Street Journal, or talk about whatever it was Leo thought was interesting. But luckily for you, I eventually started to create my own content. I think it would have gone downhill if it had been only that. The one thing that surprised me when I went back to listen to it was that the sound quality wasn't really all that bad. I was hoping it'd be more dreadful. Oh, before I forget, today is Sunday, May 13th, 2007, and this is really show number 96. I can remember wondering way back then whether I could actually do this podcasting thing. You may think me bold and wild, but I'm actually rather timid about change and starting new things. My brother Kelly could do anything. He'd embark on these amazing projects, like he decided to buy property in Hawaii and start an organic farm. What did he know about that? How could he do that? How could he think he could do it? I always wondered what gave him the courage to think he could do things like that. After he passed away and I was thinking about podcasting and I was kind of trying to get my courage up about it, I could hear him standing right behind me telling me that, of course you can do it. Why the heck were you doubting yourself, Allison? Just do it. I closed my eyes, dove into the deep end of the pool, and gave it my best shot. I had no idea what I was doing, but I decided that I couldn't afford to do it my way, analyzing, studying, doing a risk analysis. I just had to start and then figure out what it was I didn't know. Well, I didn't know a lot, but I learned a lot on the way. I jumped in and just started recording. I did 4 terrific shows, and then I stopped. They say that the most common time to pod fade is around 4 or 5 shows, so I guess I was right on schedule. I didn't know if anybody was actually listening. I couldn't think of what to say next. I was too lazy. Not really sure why I stopped. I just did. Several weeks later, I got an email, one I'll never forget. Listener Neil wrote in and said, "Hey, where's the next episode?" That's all it took. Just knowing there was someone out there, someone cared that I kept going. It did take me a little while to get back on track, but I was energized by the idea that if I stopped, Neil would be disappointed. It's a very powerful thought that people are counting on you. Special thanks to you, Neil, for your support. Hey, Tim Verporten of the fantastic podcast, the Mac Review Cast, hosted at MacReviewCast.com, sent in a really nice anniversary message. Let's take a listen, shall we?
Hello, Allison. This is Tim at the Mac Review Cast. You've been helping us out at the Mac Review Cast the past year with some great reviews. I really appreciate all you've done for us, and I just couldn't let your 2-year anniversary go by without wishing you many more years of great podcasting. I listen to the podcast as often as I can, and I always manage to learn something from you. You know, 2 years is a long time in the podcasting business, and the fact that your podcast keeps getting bigger and better only proves what I've said before. The Nozilla Cast is a great podcast with a great host. Happy anniversary, Allison. Now get back to work on next week's review for the Mac Review Cast.
Thank you so much for the kind words, Tim. Coming from you, it's high praise indeed. I've really enjoyed these past 2 years bringing so many great tools to all of you. Podcasting sure hit the world at the right time for me. If it had been any sooner, I wouldn't have been able to do it because my kids were demanding so much of my time. As teenagers, I'm lucky to get an hour or two a week with them, so podcasting keeps me out of their hair and out of the bars, I guess. Well, perhaps we should actually start the show finally, eh? Not just yet. Remember a few weeks ago when I borrowed my friend's chainsaw? There's a whole video of that fun on show number 83 from February. Anyway, I really love that chainsaw, and I wished I had one of my own. Well, my wish came true today when I got one for Mother's Day. I know, some mothers want jewelry or dinner out at some fancy schmancy restaurant, but that's just not me. Well, don't get me wrong, I do like jewelry. But, last year I got the power washer, and this year I got a chainsaw. Am I the luckiest mom in the world, or what? All right, fine. Let's buckle down and get to work. Let's start the show. Well, this was an exciting tech week for me, because on Tuesday night, as I was working on the podcast, I heard my computer make this noise. Trust me on this. This is not a sound you want to hear coming out of your computer. I had heard about this dreaded sound, so I knew what it meant. It means that your hard disk is dying, or if not, nearly dead. I watched as my screen froze, but for some reason my mouse still worked. I rebooted, knowing it was fruitless, but hey, you gotta try. And of course it wouldn't boot. I just kept hearing shh, tick, 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 tick. Okay, here's where this is a wonderful tech story. I, in my brilliance, had a backup from only 4 days before. Can you believe how smart I am? Are you as smart as me? Have you been doing regular backups in case this ever happens to you? Well, I sure hope so. I hear people saying, oh yeah, I do backups once a month. Well, can you imagine losing a month of photos or a month of work or a month of whatever your favorite hobby is? I hope you have backups. I use the terrific shareware program SuperDuper from shirt-pocket.com. The sweet little application is only $27.95 US. Think about it, $27.95 for all my data and software installation preferences, all my passwords, all my photos. Does that sound overpriced to you? Or too much work? Well, let me tell you a little bit how I use it. I choose to back up my user directory with SuperDuper, and I choose to do only changes, so I'm not doing a full back each week. That would take forever for about 120 gig that I have on there. This is called an incremental backup. A lot of people do a full system backup as a bootable image. If you do that, it means you can bring your entire system back up very quickly without reinstalling a darn thing. Your entire OS and all of your application and data come right back up. But I'll tell you why I never did this. I didn't do it on purpose. That's because I load so much garbage on my system, I figured if I ever did lose a disk, it would finally force me to do some spring cleaning and only choose to bring over those applications that I actually need. You know what it's like if you ever lived in a house too long or worked in the same office for a long time, and you have these piles of junk stored in drawers under the bed and in the closet? Well, that's what my Mac is like. The real problem, the real culprit here, is not my slovenly behavior. The problem is that Apple makes it so easy to convert from an old Mac to a new one. I've used that process over and over and over and over again. Think about it. I load about 5 applications a week on my computer. Think of all the little preference files and caches and log files just boogering up my system. Well nigh time to start over, and that's exactly what I had to do this week. After a friend of mine replaced the drive, I started over with my installation disks. I learned 2 important things in this process. First lesson. While I had purchased Tiger as a family pack a few years ago, these disks would not work to install on my new Mac. I forgot that the Intel machines were invented after Tiger came out. This wasted about 3 hours of my buddy's time because I left him with the machine, the new drive, and my wrong install disks and went to visit my daughter for the day. Poor drive guy thought the drive was messed up, thought maybe the DVD drive was messed up, so he installed a different one, put the original one back in. Oh man, he just spent a bunch of time on it. I feel terrible about that. I did give him permission to call me a nitwit, so he's got that going for him. Well, from my trip, I called him and asked him to talk to a bunch of other people nearby who I knew had just gotten Intel machines and had the installed disks. Turned out those wouldn't work either, because Apple meanly makes the original disks tailored for your specific type of hardware. So, for example, a Mac Mini disk won't work on a MacBook Pro. I say meanly because clearly if they can make a family pack CD or DVD, then you know they can make it work on all different machines. Oh well. When I got back, I installed from my original disks. But then came lesson number 2. And I hope you put this in a, just tuck it away in a far spot of your brain so it just kind of tickles your memory if this ever happens to you, not to panic. You know how when you install software on a Mac, it asks you on which disk to install? Well, it turns out the same thing happens when you install the operating system. Well, you ready for the heart attack? There's no disk showing at all. Nothing. It's just a blank screen, like pick a disk and there's no disk. Oh no, the disk is bad. My friend screwed everything up. Ah! And this is where you want to try and remember what I'm telling you. The OS X install disk includes disk utility. And if you launch that, you can partition the disk. It turns out that disk hasn't been formatted for the Macintosh. You have to do that. Well, duh. But don't you think they could have just put a little note on the screen saying launch disk utility if you don't see your disk here? Jeez. Well, anyway, even if you don't remember this little tip, just try to remember not to have a heart attack when you're faced with that blank screen, okay? All right, that ends my life lesson for the week. Back up your system, back up it weekly. Back it up weekly. Make sure you find an application and a hard drive that makes it easy for you. Because if it's hard, you're not going to do it. You want it to be easy so you don't procrastinate and avoid doing it. You'll be so happy you spent this little time if you do. I'm sure happy I invested the time. You better believe it. Well, now let's hear a word from our sponsor. I'm no electrical engineer, so the electrical system in a car is a complete mystery to me. I don't even believe electricity. I mean, the current goes this way, the electricity goes the other way. Yeah, I don't believe it. Luckily, Honda Bob has a whole section on his great website telling us how the electrical system works in a car. At hdabob.com, you can learn the interaction of the battery, alternator, lights, wiring, ignition switch, starter, fuses, gauges, and even the electronic control unit, or ECU. This brings up a good story. My son Kyle and I were trying to hook up a VCR to our TV, TiVo, stereo setup. The idea was to tape off a show for a friend of ours off of our TiVo, and we were not having any success. You see, my husband Steve was out of town at the time, and he's in charge of this sort of thing. Kyle says to me, "Mom, I think I'm going to have to be an electrical engineer." I asked him why, and he said, "Because Dad just knows all this stuff. I mean, stuff you actually need to know. And I think it's because he's an electrical engineer." Well, being a mechanical engineer myself, I was miffed. So I said, "All right, explain this then. How come Dad knows so much about cars? They don't teach that in electrical engineering school." To that, he simply replied, "Oh, that's because he hangs out with Honda Bob all the time and asks him lots of questions." I loved it. I figured that Steve's education by Honda Bob in the electrical systems of cars has really paid off. If you'd like to learn more about the electrical system in a car, click the link in the show notes to hdabob.com. Listener Bart sent in a very informative and interesting lesson/review on how to better protect your machine while surfing the net. Here's his review of NoScript.
Hi folks, this is Bart from bartbouchas.ie again, and I'm here today to talk to you about a very nice Firefox extension called NoScript. But before I go into describing the plugin itself and how it works and stuff, I just want to explain to you why this plugin is needed at all. Security is something which is always changing, particularly IT security. You know, the attacks that were popular 10 years ago simply aren't popular now. You know, initially, viruses spread by people handing around floppy disks. That's completely unheard of in this day and age. Nowadays, it's all via the internet. Initially, there were things like worms, like we had Blaster and Slammer and some of these very nasty worms. But the days of the worms seem to be gone too. And nowadays, the most common way for people's machines to get infected is to trick them into visiting a website which has some sort of code on it, which causes some sort of problem in the browser to trigger, which lets them exploit your computer. So basically, they send you an email with a link, you click on the link, you go to the link, some bad stuff happens and your computer's taken over. That is the current vector, as it's called in computer security terminology, that's most common, and it's the way that you're most at risk of getting caught out. Now, the interesting thing to note about this is that this affects all platforms equally. This isn't a Windows problem. This is a problem for everyone. So, you might ask, but how can my browser be used to attack me? Well, you may not realize it, but your browser actually executes an awful lot of code. And it's not code that you've written, it's code that the people who wrote the website have written. Now, if you're letting people run code on your machine, you're immediately putting yourself at risk. It's probably one of the most dangerous things to do. And that's why you're at risk. Now, you don't actually need this kind of code to be run on your machine to use the web. HTML is not code, it's simply a markup language, so it will display information just fine. However, nowadays the web isn't just a place of HTML and images. Nowadays the web is a place of Ajax and JavaScript and Java and Flash and all sorts of other plugins. And it's all these extra plugins that are what are putting you at risk. Now, there's an obvious and very simple solution to this risk. Turn off all those kind of features on your browser. So, no JavaScript, no Java, no Flash, no video plugins. Hang on a sec, that's just made the internet really boring, hasn't it? You know, what's the point of having this wonderful multimedia experience available if we immediately cut ourselves off from it? That's obviously not the appropriate solution. So, what we need is some form of halfway house, where we turn off all these potentially dangerous things as we're browsing sites that we don't trust, but where we can turn them on a site-by-site basis on the sites that we do trust, so that we can still go to YouTube and enjoy the nice Flash videos, so that we can still have a Web 2.0 experience on, you know, the various Google sites that do such cool things. When it comes to browser security, there's always been one simple thing you could do to protect yourself. Use Firefox. Firefox is an open source browser, and it's a particularly secure browser. Now, it's not perfect. There are often security issues with Firefox. There are often security issues with every single program out there in existence, because humans write programs, and humans are imperfect. What matters isn't whether or not your program gets security problems, because they all do. They all will. What matters is how quickly those problems are resolved. And this is where Firefox absolutely excels. Within 48 hours of a major problem becoming known, it will be fixed, often even within 24 hours. I mean, such response times are what make Firefox secure. If you're on Windows, Firefox also adds an extra layer of security by not supporting ActiveX, which is probably the most dangerous thing ever invented for the internet. It's a Microsoft technology that basically allows people to run DLL code from their website on your machine, and it's basically just the most dangerous thing around. So if you do insist on browsing with Internet Explorer, for the love of everything holy, please turn off ActiveX support. You're just asking to be totally and utterly exploited. So, apart from the quick patch times, and apart from not having ActiveX, Firefox also adds to security in another way. Firefox supports add-ons, or plugins as they used to be called, which means that if the browser doesn't do something that it should do, anyone can write a little plugin that you can then install, and hey presto, your browser now has extra features. Now, these plugins can do all sorts of cool things, and the vast majority of them really aren't security related, but there's one particularly good plugin that is security related, and it's called NoScript. You should look at NoScript as being like the built-in pop-up blocker that's in Firefox. It sits there and it doesn't let scripts run from any sites that you haven't said that you trust. So when it goes to a site, there's JavaScript on it, you haven't trusted the site, it puts a little bar across the bottom of the screen and says, I've just blocked some JavaScript, and you have a button which you can click on which gives you options. And then you can choose to either temporarily trust the site, which means that for this session only, the scripts will run on that site. Or you can choose to blacklist it, which basically means that you're never going to let those scripts run and don't even annoy me about it anymore. Or you can choose to add it to your trusted sites, which means that the scripts can run always. And really, that's the core functionality of NoScript right there. If a site isn't trusted, the scripts don't run. Instead, you get the options to trust the site or not to trust the site, etc. Now, as well as blocking JavaScript, NoScript has more power than that. It also can block Java, and it does so by default. It can also block Flash, and Flash is actually based off ECMA, which is actually the core language underneath JavaScript. So Flash is really a very specialized version of JavaScript. And it can also, even more powerfully, simply block all plugins. Now, since video has been exploited a lot recently, I don't know if you heard about the hacker conference CanSec West, where there was a MacBook Pro that was completely and totally patched, hacked into by sending it to a webpage which contained a malicious piece of Java code, which broke something in QuickTime, which let them hack the machine totally. So video plugins are actually very dangerous. This is why you want to block all plugins. So by default, NoScript doesn't do this. It only blocks Java and JavaScript, but it has the ability to block the whole kit and caboodle. So if you want to do that, and I very strongly advise that is what you do, you just simply take the following steps. You click on the little NoScript icon at the bottom of the screen, and that will bring up a little menu. Then you go to Options, which will bring up a pop-up window. Then you click on the Advanced tab, and then inside that you have a little subset of tabs, and you click on the Untrusted tab, and you simply put a check mark beside Forbid Macromedia Flash, and another check mark beside Forbid Other Plugins. And at that stage, just click on OK, and you now have about as secure a browser as you are going to get. However, I must give you a word of warning. NoScript isn't like a virus scanner. Simply having it installed does not provide you with any protection whatsoever. The protection comes from how you use it. If you install NoScript and then proceed to allow every single web page to run every single script it wants, you may as well not have bothered installing the plugin. You have gained absolutely nothing. Okay, it all comes down to your decisions as to what you do and don't trust. Now, large, well-known sites you can by all means trust. And, it's really, you need to use your common sense. What this plugin does is it gives you the power to control what you do and don't trust, rather than it being an all-or-nothing decision. Something I will caution you about, though, is that the most dangerous types of sites of all are sites where users can basically edit the site themselves. So things like MySpace and Facebook and those kind of things, they are pretty much the most dangerous types of sites possible, because users create that content, and those users could be out to get you. This isn't just, pie-in-the-sky stuff. Last year there actually was a virus which did propagate, and it did use MySpace, and it did so by using a browser plugin. In this case, it was a browser plugin written by Apple, it was the QuickTime plugin, but this just shows that this isn't imagined danger. This danger is real. There were millions of computers infected with the MySpace virus via MySpace, via the QuickTime plugin. If they were using the NoScript extension and they had not trusted MySpace, then that simply wouldn't have happened. They would have been safe. So, in summary, NoScript is a plugin that works exceptionally well. Its interface is very good. It does exactly what it says on the tin. It's not some form of panacea that will solve everything for you. Instead, it's a tool that gives you the power to decide for yourself what level of risk to take on the internet. It gives you a real halfway house between absolutely no protection and total protection. In other words, running absolutely every JavaScript or absolutely no JavaScript. And it lets you decide for yourself where you think the balance lies and just how much of a risk you're planning on taking. It's a very, very small plugin, works very well, so I would strongly recommend that if you want to be safe on the web, use Firefox and use NoScript. So with that, I'll end and just say happy browsing, one and all.
After hearing Bart's review, I called him up on Skype to argue with him about this. I was worried that NoScript really would take all the fun out of surfing and make it a bunch of work. He and I both went to the same site, me without NoScript, and him protected so we could do some comparisons. I should warn that I had FlashBlack on before I started. We decided the heinous MySpace would be a good place to start, and what we found was that he was able to see the content pretty darn well. Saw pictures, saw animated GIFs, he saw all the text. He was missing the Flash videos and some banner ads that I had happily blinking in my face so that I was about to have an epileptic fit or something. Well, that was enough to make me give it a try. What I'm going to do is I'm going to keep using FlashBlock I should remind you, Flashbox is the extension I told you about a while back. It gives you a big arrow where Flash videos should be, so you know where they are, but you get to choose whether or not to play them. And you can play them individually, which I really like. So some of the ads, if they're in Flash, you just don't hit those, but you hit the one you wanted to see. So then I'm telling NoScript to let Flash through, so Flashbox can still catch it. I'll let you know if this makes me nuts over the next week, or whether I can live with this much protection. In any case, thanks, Bart, for the education and the great tip. I put a link in the show notes to your blog and to the NoScript extension. This week's installment of the Growl series was recorded for Tim Verporten's Mac ReviewCast. Tim is moving from an apartment to a house this week, and he considered not doing a podcast, but, you know, he's done 2 straight years without missing a show. Instead, he asked all of his regular contributors, like me, to gang up on the same week and all send in a review. He calls it the All-Star Cast. I like it. I figured the Growl series would be a good place to start his listeners, and I found a really sweet tool this week that's Growl-enabled. Let's give a listen. Hi, Tim. Allison Sheridan here of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com. Yesterday, I had a hard drive failure on my MacBook Pro, so I'm really limping along here on borrowed hardware, but I figured that if you could keep the podcast going while you moved all the way across the country, I could pull off a small segment on less than optimal hardware. Well, on my podcast, I've been plowing through all of the Growl-enabled applications I can find. Growl is a notification add-on to other programs. If an application is Growl-enabled, when a certain kind of events occur, messages sort of float onto your screen telling you about the action. Growl is built into a lot of applications, like Adium, for example, the fantastic chat program that supports all kinds of services from AIM to Jabber to ICQ and more. When someone sends a message to you, Growl will make that message come to the front of your screen. It's really, really handy. Another good example, I know we've talked about Transmit quite a few times. It's a great FTP client. When a file is done transferring, Growl will hover over your screen to tell you that it's done. Those are just a few of the tools I've reviewed over the past few weeks and how much more fun Growl makes them. I discovered that at the Growl site, growl.info, they have listed all of the applications that are Growl-enabled. It's a great place to find new and interesting applications for the Macintosh. This week, I'm going to look at the different email programs that support Growl. There's a couple of old favorites in there. Entourage from Microsoft, which used to be one of my favorites until Apple Mail got as good as it is. Gazmail is in there, which I reviewed for the Mac ReviewCast just a while ago. It's also Growl-enabled. Yahoo Mail supports Growl, too. Well, that's kind of where the familiarity ends. I'm going to start going through all of the mail applications over the next couple of weeks. The first in this series is called Balzac. Isn't that a great name? Sounds like something out of Star Trek. Well, according to the developer's site at, mecanisme.net, it's mecanisme.net, Balzac is a new email application for OS 10.4 and above, which aims to provide a simple view on your mail whilst allowing fast, sophisticated searches of past correspondence. It has been written to utilize all the advanced services available in OS 10, from the address book to the built-in spell checker. Well, not only that, it's got an awesome icon, sort of a cross between a strange planet and some weird molecular-level formation. I'm a sucker for a cool icon. Anyway, Balzac kind of floats onto the screen when it comes up, which is kind of pleasing. It kind of goes whoosh as it comes on. The left-hand pane has the normal inbox and an icon for all mail. Well, all mail is kind of cool. If you click on that, it shows an automatic sort underneath it, showing you this week and this month. Within this month, it also showed mailing lists separately. Next down in the list was an icon for people, and in there it automatically sorts your mail by who it's from. So like you know it's from Bob, you can just look at the list and see Bob. Well, since this program, when it comes up, comes preloaded with an email from the developer, Kenny Grant, the people category has a sort on From Kenny. Next down the icon list is flavors. Wasn't obvious to me right off the bat what flavors were, and the help menu didn't list it anywhere. Sure, it's something wonderful. I just didn't figure out what it was. As you travel down the icon list on the left, you'll find some more traditional items, like to-dos, which is kind of nice to have built into an email program, drafts, outbox, sent, spam, and trash. All of the icons are beautifully done, by the way, so there's no worry of confusing which icon you want to click. Across the top, there are a ton more icons, most of which are focused on making it easy to search. I love this because I'm a complete sloth about ever deleting any email, so being able to sort it more easily would be a real joy. Beyond the usual suspects of new, reply, and forward, there's an icon for similar. Not quite sure what it compares, but this could be a really interesting feature once I have a bunch of email in there to work with. You can add tags for more searchability. There's an icon to see just your unread emails. And if for some reason you want another icon to see your spam, there's a button for that too. You can also save the view setup you've created. At the bottom, there's a slot for entering search terms, always at the ready. Well, Balzac looks like it could be a great email utility. I plan to try it out this week and put it through its paces. That is, after I get my MacBook Pro back from sickbay. If this program sounds interesting to you, check it out at mecanisme.net. Hey, Tim, good luck with the move, and take that Advil like I told you. Talk to you next week. Well, that was fun. I got to keep playing with Balzac. After the hard disk crash, I need to put it onto this system because it was on my other system that I used while recording for Tim. I actually had to do it while I was still waiting for the other drive to get fixed. I'm guessing most of you use Google for searching. I mean, who doesn't? But sometimes you want to search Wikipedia, right? Or what about when you're looking for a YouTube video? Or what if you want to find a cool picture on Flickr? Or a story you heard about on Slashdot? I could go on and on, but you get the idea. You search for things all over the place. For each of these searches, you have to navigate to their site, then find the search window, and search from there. What if you could get to all of these searches in one place? Listener Leo sent me the solution. It's called Sputter. Of course, they've taken the E out, so it's sputtr.com. It's beautifully simple. It's got a huge search window in the middle, like big candy kind of buttons. The search window defaults to Google, which is perfect. Then there's a grid of 27 nice blocky icons below to change the search site to any of the ones I mentioned, plus a ton more. Okay, 22 more than I mentioned. If you hover over any of the buttons, then Sputter tells the show the name of the search you've chosen. You click on it, and then the search is executed to that site. I'm making this sound really complicated, but you'll get the hang of this site instantly when you go there, and I bet you start using it. Check it out at sputter.com. Oh, and you can even suggest more. I suggested one of my favorites, answers.com, and now it's up there. Thanks, Leo, for an excellent tip. Well, I've been having a lot of weird coincidences lately. One of the message boards I follow, a guy forwarded a message from his friend Andrew asking whether anyone on the board happened to live near his mother in West Los Angeles. Andrew lives in Northern California, and it's really hard to support his mom on her Mac from so far away. Heck, it's pretty hard to support a relative even when they're in your own house. You know how annoying that can be, especially if you love him. Somehow it seems harder. Anyway, I wrote to Andrew and suggested I might be of some help, at least maybe getting VNC on her computer so he could support her remotely. Andrew wrote back, and guess what? He's already a listener to the NoSillaCast. How cool is that? At least I won't have to prove my credentials. Well, Andrew went on to give me a tip on an alternative to Quicksilver. Here's what he wrote. P.S. I know you're a fan of Quicksilver. Well, I gave up on Quicksilver last year because it tended to slow down on my G4-based Macs. And because I really only was using it as an application launcher, it was way overkill. I heard about Namely on a podcast. I think it was on Tim Verporten's Mac ReviewCast. Well, now I'm hooked on it. I've got Namely on all my Macs and wouldn't be without it. It's free, fast, and does the one thing it does really well. Check it out at amarsagu.info. Well, Andrew, I decided to check it out, and I also did verify that Tim Verporten did talk about Namely back in 2006. I guess I'm not stepping on any toes doing a review a year later. I downloaded and installed Namely. Yes, I do remember how I just said that I finished spring cleaning on my disk after my disk crash. Here I am loading it up with new software because someone said, hey, this is cool. Well, you didn't actually think I'd change my ways and be neat and tidy, did you? What would we have to talk about every week if I did? Like Andrew, I only use Quicksilver as an application launcher, so I thought giving Namely a try was a good idea. Not that I have any problems with Quicksilver in speed or size to load, but it's always fun to try another application, even if it gives the same functionality I use. You're thinking, why would she want a piece of software that does less stuff, but does the stuff she already needs? Well, it's because it's my sacred duty to test out software for you, so you don't have to do it. Installation of Namely was trivial. You tell Namely next what keystroke you'd like to use to trigger it, and you're off and running. I tested it out on a few applications, and it worked fine, and then something awful happened. I asked it to launch Firefox, just as I do in Quicksilver. I typed fire and then hit the carriage return as soon as I saw the icon come up in the window. What I didn't notice quickly enough, before I hit the carriage return, was that Namely had found two instances of Firefox. The first one was actually the Windows application inside Parallels. That wasn't a good thing, as it meant that Parallels launched and then launched Windows, which is pretty quick if you have a paused virtual machine, but it was definitely not something I wanted to have happen. I was gonna slam Namely for this, as Quicksilver doesn't seem to recognize the Windows applications, so it doesn't get confused. But then I went to the Namely preferences and discovered that they have a section where you can exclude places and applications from being launched in Namely. I clicked the plus button, navigated to the Windows applications folder, and voila, Namely now only gives me Mac applications. Then I started thinking about it. Might actually be kind of cool to be able to launch the Windows applications from within OS X. So having the flexibility is an enhancement, not a bug. Well, now I'm kind of mad that Quicksilver won't let me do it. So, of course, I was forced to go see if Quicksilver could do it. And, of course, it can. I did essentially the inverse experiment in Quicksilver. I went to the Catalog tab and then added the Windows application folder for scanning. Now I have both Firefoxes coming up. Oh, wait. I don't actually want it to do that, so I went back and undid that change in Quicksilver, but it seems to keep the catalog stuff around for a bit. Sure hope it goes away eventually. In any case, if you want a simple, elegant application launcher, on Andrew's recommendation and my endorsement of that recommendation, check out Namely from amarsagu.info. There's links in the show notes as always. Well, that's going to wind up this 2-year anniversary show. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll stick around for another year or two. Who knows what it's going to be like in the interweb then? Please keep all of your great emails coming by sending them to me at allison@podfeet.com or send in audio comments and reviews to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.